down there to attend a conference on theosophy and science, and presented some of my original writings on Blavatsky and the secret doctrine in light of modern science, and talked about the heart doctrine, the mystical view that the origins of human consciousness has to do with the heart, and self-realization involves the awakening of the heart. I see the promotion of this consciousness of the heart as the next step in terms of the evolution of humankind. One yogi says that in states of samadhi, there's instinctual recognition of the fact that your I is your jiva atmic principle, or your bliss sheath, is within the heart. And in samadhi, there's direct realization of this. So I'm trying to, in my work, present the idea of the heart doctrine and how that's elaborated within all the different religious traditions of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, Sufism, and the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky and other sources. So it's an original alternative view of the origins of human consciousness compared with the head doctrine, which is the major belief in modern science that the brain and the head somehow produces consciousness. So the heart doctrine is implicit within Blavatsky's The Voice of the Silence, her poetic account of the life of the soul and the nature of the soul. It's also implied in the secret doctrine, where the stanzas of Zen suggest the suns expand and contract through their own selves and hearts. So it suggests that the life principle within the human being emerges from within the depths of the heart. I still haven't learned how to present some of my studies on the physics of the secret doctrine in a completely suitable form yet. I'm trying to show in my work how Blavatsky's secret doctrine anticipated the newest ideas in physics, and exploring the idea that human beings have zero-point centers. It's like a zero-point can be considered as a thing, like a divine spark or God spark within the human being. So a zero-point might be considered as a tiny, tiny little particle or element, what Blavatsky would call a monad. And a zero point can also be considered like a portal between dimensions, that you might, from one dimension, narrow something to a zero point and then pass through a zero point, which might be like a little black hole, a mini black hole, and you might open up into higher dimensions. And there's a whole kind of physics to zero point centers. The idea of zero points has become popular in modern physics in terms of talking about the zero-point fields and how we exist within zero-point fields, which are the electromagnetic fields within the quantum vacuum. But as far as I know, I'm the only one suggesting that human beings have such zero-point centers, not just that we exist in zero-point fields, but that we, our life center is actually some zero-point condition. So I was fortunate enough to stay in New Zealand for almost 5 months, and altogether gave almost 30 talks on my work, both the heart doctrine and on the physics of the secret doctrine. New Zealand's an absolutely beautiful country, a special country. Feel the soul of the land still in New Zealand. And I'd like to thank all those New Zealanders who were so helpful to me and supported my work and my giving presentations on my work through the islands. People were very kind to me there and supported me to enable me to give that lecture tour. So I went from late fall, nice pleasant weather in New Zealand, and I've arrived home to 15 centimeters of snow, and I think another 20 or 25 today. It's been a heavy Ottawa winter, lots of snow and cold. So So I don't know what happened to global warming. I guess not in Ottawa this year. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi, Chris.
James Motha, the co-host, James handled the last show. It was on the Gurdjieff Uspensky work. And Jim's a regular co-host of Zero Point Radio. How's it your way, Jim? Are you getting much snow?
Oh, it's snowing like it's going out of style here. And, yeah, as you say, global warming has taken a detour around Toronto, too. Quite amazing, actually, this year in Ottawa and Toronto has record snowfalls, I think, for both cities. Welcome back. And I just wanted to ask you a question about, I know from talking to you before about some of your talks there that you gave over 30 lectures, but you talked on different things at different places and different times. Were there any kind of highlights to you that sort of stood out in terms of how you were received or questions that you received from your audiences? Were there certain things that you felt people really responded to in terms of your work?
Yeah. I always gave my talk on consciousness and the heart and the mysteries of the heart. That was the primary talk I gave at centers at cities when I was giving one talk. And I find that is the most personally valuable and relevant to people. And the heart doctrine teaching, it ties together a lot of things for people. Like I feel that people intuitively know it, and it makes sense when they hear me speak of it. And I like lecturing. I talk sometimes about how in modern science, people think the emotional centers, they relate it to the limbic system and because of how that's involved in emotional learning. And I like it when I say, you know, how many people go home and tell their partner, you know, I love you with all my head, you know, and how if our emotional center was really in our head, how funny that would sound. You know, you have your sweet head, you know, instead of your sweetheart. You know, you send someone a Valentine with a picture of a brain on it, you know, for Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
So I like that. That's funny, you know, and then how people intuitively, you know, it's all in our language. People know that there's a psychology to the heart and how that's been completely neglected, that viewpoint in modern science for over the past century. And how the psychology of the heart was dismissed with the idea of a psychology of the soul. You know, so I like the in a way, the inherent logic of the heart doctrine becomes more and more apparent to me as I teach it. And just in my own being, self-awareness, how crazy it is in a way to assume that all our awareness of being is only centered up in our head, and that the brain is producing consciousness in the head. Like it's totally inconsistent with direct experiential self-knowledge. So I find when I teach on the heart doctrine, it pulls things together for people, and it makes such sense. You know, even ideas about consciousness connected to blood flow in the body. And how it's not produced by neurological activity, but it's connected to blood flow. I like doing that demonstrations. I like the demonstrations. I use the pointing game developed by Swami Prabhupada, Jim, you know, where I get people to point to different, their left ear and their right foot and the wall and the ceiling, and then get people to point to themselves, and how consistently people point, the majority of people point towards their heart area. It just demonstrates that, in my view, how people have intuitive knowledge of the heart doctrine, because we sense the center of our being, self-existence, we associate it with the heart in our own inner experience. So I gave the heart doctrine teaching the most, and generally found that my material, I have so much material comparing the secret doctrine to modern science that it really needs to be developed in a workshop, something like that, where people hear the lecture and it's spread out more, and they get to read the stanzas, and kind of it takes time to appreciate it. So I often found that those lectures, at times, you know, I have to cover such a breadth of material that, to explain it to some of the complexities of it, like the holographic model in physics, and this particularly is difficult to explain. But even that is valuable. So I talked on those subjects, and then the last time around, I spoke a little bit on the world situation in all of the settings. It was shocking to me how often the majority of people knew, had learned that 9/11 was questionable and the whole 9/11 was an inside job. The majority of people down there know it, you know, and I was shocked by that. Now, New Zealanders tend to be better informed than, say, Canadians and Americans, you know. That was kind of interesting. And seeing the responsiveness to people of someone who wanted to kind of talk about the world situation, I was surprised by that. I think a lot of people learn about it on their own and are relatively isolated in their understanding. So it was interesting to share a little bit around that with different groups. So those are a few of the highlights. And
yeah. It's interesting that you should mention this about, the response of people to the heart doctrine, because I think I may have mentioned to you a few weeks ago in an email that I was at this bookstore that I frequent and where I know a lot of the people at work, and we were having a discussion one night, and I was talking about some of your ideas about the heart doctrine, and one of the people there has some familiarity with metaphysics and is interested in Blavatsky and Gurdjieff, and another person, his parents are both Buddhists and his father runs a Buddhist center, and he has something of a background in Eastern religions, and then the third person describes herself as sort of a skeptic and a materialist, but is very curious and interested, and we were talking about various aspects of it, of the heart doctrine, and when I said, you know, that I brought the example about, that you don't love somebody with all your limbic system, everybody burst out laughing, and one of the guy who's the parents are Buddhists, just sort of volunteered. He said, you know, that really your experience is more in your heart and your emotional experiences are more in your stomach and your guts. And I said, yeah, exactly. You know, that the idea that our experiences are, obviously our brains are involved in mediating everything, but we more directly experience our emotions in our solar and gastric and cardiac plexes and nerve plexes of the sympathetic nervous system rather than in our heads, you know. And as you say, it's like people have an intuitive, I think, grasp of this. And when you I find it's interesting that people much more readily, I think, respond to this challenge to kind of conventional thinking about the nature of consciousness than, say, some other aspects of the, like, esoteric challenges. I find that very interesting. And as you say, I've done that pointing game, too, with people, and I've never seen anybody point to their head when they ask them, you know, point to yourself. They all point to their chest, to their heart.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely the majority of people do. I mean, I have seen a few people point to their heads, and sometimes to people's throat areas, but then they have to hold their hand out further from them, and it's like there's confusion between the head and the heart, so they're kind of in between almost. That's why, like, your reaction talking to those people and how people laughed when you said, you know, I love you with all my limbic system, you know, that's exactly it. Like, it just, the people have that intuitive knowledge, and then when you formulate that, what it implies, like, scientifically in terms of understanding the enigmas of human consciousness, well, then that's really valuable, because after a while you really appreciate, wow, is what a limiting view of a human being that we only have consciousness in the head where the brain is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not really, it's not based on any scientific fact. It's more an assumption made by the majority of scientists, but it's unthinking, you know, because no one's been able to prove what consciousness is or how it's produced in the brain, and And psychologists and scientists generally don't seem to use self-study as a method of, you know, trying to explore what consciousness is. So we've got this kind of idea, which is so inconsistent with immediate self-experience if you go into it.
Yeah, and you know, the more I study the history of the last 300 years of Western science, the more convinced I've become. You just once you have the idea that this is a question, and you begin to sort of understand the history of how things developed in terms of understanding consciousness and the rise of the mechanistic model in science, you realize how incredibly arbitrary all these conventional assumptions are about the nature of consciousness, and how this all it plays out in a very discernible fashion, where consciousness is gradually and progressively removed from every aspect of the universe, and eventually it's encased inside the skulls of human beings. As I think it was Theodore Roszak I was reading says, interesting, because in terms of the physical mechanisms of the body, that the body's boundaries are permeated by influences, physical influences coming and going, but the only thing that's really encased within the human being is consciousness. It's the only thing that you know, that science doesn't sort of recognize as being permeable in human beings. And really, as he points out, like he talks about how the consciousness is assigned to the headquarters, and how really modern thinkers are really head cases, and that they have a very kind of limited understanding of experience and a very very limited view of how consciousness applies to a human being, and how like it's just withdrawn and put in the head, and that's the end of it. When you really begin to challenge, like, the idea of blood flow is so important in terms of understanding how consciousness permeates the entire body.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the other experiential demonstration I like to do, is where I get people to put their hands together and see if they're about the same size, and then take their hands apart and put their attention into their dominant hand. And then if you take 15, 20 seconds and people attempt that, they put their hands back together. And a significant number of people in the group will find that one of the hands that they put awareness into has grown and expanded, and it's thicker and a bit longer. So it kind of really, well, how can you explain that by the head doctrine that consciousness is just in the head? And you know, whereas it makes immediate sense in terms of self-experience. You can put your hand, attention in your hand, and feel your hand, and you can feel how you're connected to blood flow. Like, you can feel the blood flow in your body very directly, you know. And there's no way of kind of explaining that in contemporary views on consciousness. It was interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
one day I had a capsule of niacin, you know, vitamin B12, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing how that brings on like a flush all through your body within a minute or so. And it's interesting, I was aware of doing that, like how much I could feel myself all through my body connected to my blood flow, because the niacin kind of brings out, lets you sense your blood flow like that. So,
yeah. Man.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, I'm sorry, I'm getting a lot of static here. I don't know if you can hear me properly, but
yeah,
the other example is what happens when you become sexually aroused, is you have a flow of blood to your sex organs, and that's where you experience yourself. Your center of gravity shifts to your sexual organs. I mean, it's a very simple example. Or if you lie on your arm and cut off the blood flow, you lose a feeling of your arm. So on some basic level, our experiences of ourselves as physical beings is related to blood flow. And that's, you know, that's one of the things, as I say, Rupert Sheldrake uses this phrase. I thought I invented it, but I found it in one of Rupert Sheldrake's books too, is that if you read most contemporary commentators on consciousness and most theorists, it's almost as if they're disembodied beings. It's everything is referred to as the head, you know, and all consciousness is in the head. It's like we were talking one time, and you said that if you see a book on consciousness, there'll be a picture of a brain on the cover. And it was funny because I had just been reading Conversations on Consciousness, and there were a picture of two brains on it, so it was twice as much consciousness in it, I guess.
That book had nine brains on it.
No, it has two brains on the cover, but...
Oh, just two. Oh, I thought it had little... Yeah.
But the point is that this has become such an ingrained assumption in contemporary thought that the brain produces consciousness, and yet it really is one of the great metaphysical assumptions of modern thought, is that somehow the brain produces consciousness. I think most people would be shocked to realize that there's really no evidence for this, you know. I mean, it's widely assumed. It might even be true, but, I mean, there absolutely is no evidence, scientific evidence. It's just an assumption.
Yeah.
And yet, the other part of it, too, is that this fits because in a way, because science and the rise of the mechanistic model over the last 300 years has taken all consciousness out of the universe, there's no place for consciousness to come from, you know. It has to be produced in the brain, and that's why it's so misleading, and it reinforces the misleading misunderstanding of the nature of the universe, too, because really, from an esoteric viewpoint, you know, as Blavatsky says, there's one indivisible intelligence which thrills through every atom of creation or the universe, and that's a completely different understanding, is the idea that really, on different levels, the entire universe possesses some sort of level of consciousness.
Yeah, and that you have that kind of absolute consciousness that permeates everywhere.
Yeah.
That we're kind of rooted into that or can taste of that. Yeah. Yeah, it's like you see the issues of consciousness. I mean, they're so important because it all ties then into the issue of the existence of the human spirit and soul. And so that's why it's such a profound enigma, because not just answering what is the material base for consciousness, it's asking, you know, is there a whole higher dimensional metaphysics to consciousness? And the new physics allows us to understand how the heart really could be higher dimensional, and, you know, it all makes sense. Like, the new models of physics are really so profound. The ideas about how much information can be within space and how much energy is within space, and the world, in a way, is nothing like what it appears to our senses. So
yeah, and it also leads to, like, one of the major, most important points about the new physics is that it really challenges the idea it puts forward a model in which the idea of non-locality can make sense. You know, the idea that things aren't transmitted strictly through contiguous elements in space, but rather there's some way that somehow information is beyond space and time and manifests in space and in time, but from a higher dimensional source.
Yeah, I agree. That's so valuable. It's interesting, like, how you see in Western science, the materialist physics wanted to deny non-local effects so long, even though they're intrinsic to quantum field theories. But they wanted to deny non-local effects. And then to read in Blavatsky, where Blavatsky at one point says that there are no actions which ultimately do not involve action at a distance, and that everything involves action at a distance, and how to understand anything as part of the whole ultimately. So as you try to understand anything, it kind of merges with the whole, and so everything is informed non-locally, all phenomena. And it's like the new science. You see how information is third force in the new science. Like the old science was matter and energy, and the kind of new age thing was, oh, everything is energy.
Yeah.
So all matter is also energy, and then they think that's kind of new age, but really the newer theories in physics and in mysticism regard information and mind as a third force that permeates space. So everything is material, everything is energetic, and everything embodies intelligence. So it gives a whole new kind of depth to trying to understand ourselves.
Yeah, and that's a perfect example of the third force of being intelligence or consciousness as being an example of how the sacred law of three in the Gurdjieff teaching, or in all esoteric teachings, is the threefoldness of things, whether it's the Christian Trinity or whether it's the three gunas in Hinduism, and it's through all systems, and yet it anticipates that from that perspective you could anticipate that there is something beyond matter and energy in modern physics, and that's information, and that's interesting in the sense that people like Carl Sagan and Richard Dawkins say that religious teachings don't provide any kind of model which would predict anything. Well, I would say that that's in terms of the esoteric aspects of religious teachings, they do predict certain things that science has confirmed, and that's a prime example, like a really basic example of something that's really of incredibly profound importance, that has been known for thousands of years in esoteric teachings, and which now modern science is beginning to recognize.
Yeah, non-local effects are really important, and how everything is part of the whole. So it's interesting to see in the new physics how physicists are seeing the basis for which things could be part of the whole, all through non-local effects and such.
Yeah, and it's like, I think one of the, somebody said that really the EPR paradox, which establishes non-local effects, Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen, is the most significant discovery of the 20th century physics. And it's interesting, when you read the work of David Bohm, I'm always struck when reading him that his development of the holographic theory was really prompted by, he was interested in the hidden variables in both quantum theory and relativity theory, and he says that for different reasons, both quantum theory and relativity theory, even though they're very different in many ways, both point to the ultimate indivisibility of everything in creation, and that was sort of the prompt for him to try to understand, well, there must be some sort of higher dimensional means of resolving these contradictions that we see on a certain level in physical reality, and that was his prime motive. And he's very good at explicating how physicists can recognize these contradictions in their theories, and yet pretend or act as if they don't recognize them. He cites this in various examples in both relativity theory and in quantum theory, and says that they just sort of soldier on and sort of ignore these things. And I would say, the whole idea of non-locality is one of those things which is so strange that it in some way it seems like it can't be true. But really, what it points to is that our understanding of things is so incomplete that we need to kind of go beyond our current understanding, our current models, to develop a model in which it could be true, because in some way it is true.
Yeah, I think most scientists deal with it like they compartmentalize it in their minds. Like they consider, non-locality, you might be able to demonstrate its occurrence at quantum levels and talking about basic quantum theory, but then they don't think, how you can't jump from to understand the nature of a quanta to understanding like a whole quantum system living being like a human being. They don't know how to bridge that gap. So the scientists will think, non-locality, okay, that's some kind of quantum phenomena in particle physics, but they don't extrapolate and see what that might mean if we consider the whole human being as a quantum system, and how we could be non-locally interconnected to other people or other phenomena, and how it might be a basis for synchronous things happening in our lives, like how different sets of happenings and events are all embody a particular pattern of meaning, so that synchronous things happen, that periods where there's all this hidden meaning between events and things co-occur together, and they seem interrelated, but, you know, it's like what Jung calls an acausal principle, kind of a synchronous interconnectedness between things. And we have no way of explaining that, and synchronous events show an under pattern of meaning that is incorporated into these phenomena, these different orders of scale. Like, it's not particle physics. It's, you know, thinking of someone and then they call you, or you're thinking, want to know something, and then something comes to you that elaborates on what you're studying or learning about or have questions about. There's so kind of so many complex psychological phenomena that people don't even attempt to offer understanding explanations for. No one considers them seriously. You know, how could synchronous events be explained in terms of the physics? What's the physics of that? And I think that, you know, so anyway, I was just trying to say that scientists see non-locality, they compartmentalize it in their mind and think that's something that only applies within physics, but they don't think that, okay, how do we apply that at different levels of complexity to understanding a living being and what it means for us. So I think we need to kind of bridge those levels. Certainly, yeah. The idea that human beings have a zero point kind of puts everything in a new light, because then there can be this whole higher dimensional physics centered on the human heart.
Yeah, I was going to ask you actually to maybe just comment a little further on that in terms of well, even on a physical level, how the human heart is, the electromagnetic field around the human heart is 5,000 times stronger than that of the brain, and how that
yeah, the electromagnetic volume yeah of the heart
yeah.
5,000 times greater than the volume of the brain in the head. So how, if we consider the human being as a quantum system, well, our center would be within the heart rather than in the head. So that, yeah, that's really important. And then I think there's a really interesting clue as to the nature of a human being, like how it's said when you approach death, how all the life energy and consciousness is said to gather again at the heart, and the consciousness withdraws through the heart, and it's discussed by the Dalai Lama, and it's as consciousness is withdrawn into the heart that I think the heart actually functions like a black hole computer. And that as that consciousness withdraws into the black hole of the heart, you can experience the quantum field information about all these things that have happened to you in your life. It's like all of it exists simultaneously in the quantum field information. So, you know, there's a phenomena like life review experiences people have, that it offers you a possible physics of how that might be possible. That the heart, in a way, is a computer, and it functions, I think, has white hole and black hole dynamics to the heart. Like, there's this whole zero-point metaphysics to the human heart. It's an amazing alternative conception of the nature of human existence than what people are ordinarily exposed to. You know, the idea that we just live animals that live and die with a physical body. You know, it's really so limiting and leaves so many things unexplained.
Yeah, that's a really wonderful example that you just of what you were just speaking about that phenomena has been experienced by many people and been recounted by many people of having a life review where you simultaneously sort of see the whole of your entire life passes before you at a moment of potential death or a moment in which your heart stops and a cardiac arrest. And yet nobody ever really, it's an anomaly, nobody really tries to explain it, but it starts to take, because really what you have is you have somehow a collapse of time and space, and you just have like the pure information element, which is experienced simultaneously or virtually simultaneously, which is incredible. And really, when you combine that with the whole idea of how consciousness is said in the esoteric teachings and the heart doctrine is to manifest out of an infinitesimally small point within the heart, it fits perfectly with that model. And then, of course, also with the anomalies of the start of the spark in the heart and the SA node in the heart.
Which might also
comment on that, because that I think is really intriguing. I think that's really an important enigma within modern science.
Yes, ever so. It's like how there's that fundamental of enigma of consciousness. No one can explain that. And then you look at the science of the heart, and scientists are unable to provide a materialist account of how the heart generates the electrical impulses that bring life into the living organism. And so there's no mechanical interpretation or explanation of that event. So, again, it supports the kind of mystical view that really there's higher dimensions to the human heart. And I think it's most useful to see it in a Kabbalistic way, that there are worlds of emanation, creation, formation, and the world made. And each of those are these higher dimensions existing within, behind the heart, the actual physical heart. So you have a physical heart, but then you have a psychical heart, a spiritual heart, and then finally a divine source emanation. So there's this higher dimensional nature, physics, to the human heart. And those levels of the heart are like, exist within the zero-point fields. And in physics, it makes sense that there are zero-point fields, and in fact, if you did have a divine source emanation, it would have an effect. You know, you can model how we could exist within these different zero-point fields, all surrounding a central point. So it does provide a kind of way of conceiving a human being's multidimensionality. So today we were going to, last week, Jim, you spoke of the Gurdjieff-Uspensky material, and we were going to pick up on that today, and you were going to kind of continue your discussion of that, and we can kind of do that maybe for an hour, and then open up the lines a little bit and see if anyone wants to phone in with any questions or comments. And I can provide some commentary as we go along, and you're talking of Gurdjieff and Uspensky.
Yeah, okay. I last week I gave a presentation on the life of Gurdjieff, and really I didn't try, what I tried to do was just sort of introduce some of the perspective on some of the enigmas and the mysteries surrounding his life, which was very enigmatic and very mysterious, and I didn't try to provide an overview of his entire life. I just sort of thought, well, I'll present what I can present and try to continue this in future talks, because I wanted to focus on his relationship with Uspensky in Russia before the Russian Revolution, and I wanted to sort of examine some aspects of their relationship. I'll just sort of try to recap some of the things that I discussed, because I'm going to try to build this up over weeks. But one of the reasons why I'm presenting on Gurdjieff himself, one of the reasons why it's important to understand Gurdjieff, is that I think his level of consciousness and being were so unique that they really that trying to come to terms with who he was in terms of gaining a sense of him as a person and who is of a higher level of consciousness and being is important in the sense that it provides an understanding of esotericism, and it challenges kind of an assumption in the West that everyone is of equal level of consciousness and being, that some people are smarter than others and some people are more sensitive, but we don't really have this understanding in the West of masters and teachers, and I think in the kind of the skeptical climate that exists now, that most people would sort of dismiss out of hand this idea. But I think in reviewing Gurdjieff's life and reviewing his relationship with his pupils, most especially Uspensky, this issue of levels of consciousness and being is really brought into focus, and I think it's really important to try to understand it. I explained last week that Gurdjieff was born in, nobody really knows when he was born, which is befitting a man of great mystery and an enigma like him, but he was supposedly born sometime around 1872 in Caucasus, in what was at the time Russia and is now Armenia, and that he grew up as a rather precocious child who very early on in his life was confronted with various mysteries and enigmas that he couldn't explain and that no one else could explain. And eventually this led him to formulate a name for himself, which was that he wanted to understand the nature of human existence and the purpose of human existence. And as a result of this, he had a variety of unusual experiences, as I say, when he was a youth, which sort of prompted this. But very early on, he began to travel throughout the Mid and the Far East in search of what he believed was the existence of higher wisdom. And eventually joined together with a group of other people who had this same aim, and they called themselves the Seekers After Truth. And each of these people had certain areas of expertise and special interest, and they traveled in groups together and sometimes on their own in search of this what they believed was this ancient wisdom, and they would gather together and compare notes and try to teach one another what they'd learned as a result of their searches. Now, that account comes from a book which Gurdjieff wrote called Meetings with Remarkable Men, and it describes this search that he was on, and we can't really believe any of this factually. I mean, some of it may be based in truth, some of it obviously is. It refers to historical events in Gurdjieff's life, but really it's an allegory. The book is an allegory, in my opinion, about what searching for truth means, and really, rather than being too fixated on the details, I think what he's trying to suggest is that the search for truth involves much more of a heroic struggle and sacrifice than most people are accustomed to assuming that it's just a matter of gaining knowledge. And what Gurdjieff's book really suggests is that no, there's a struggle and there's sacrifice and there's a great deal of unlearning as well as learning. And as I pointed out last week, in terms of reading about Gurdjieff, there are many, many very good books written about him, and there are many favorable books about him. There are many very critical articles about him and critical books about him. And everybody seems to have a different perspective on this man and his life. And again, it's difficult to say that anybody has actually captured the truth of him, because in a sense I don't think anybody's really come to grips with who Gurdjieff was. But at the same time, I explained that Chris and I, when we were in graduate school studying psychology in the mid-70s, Chris discovered Gurdjieff's teaching, The Fourth Way, through his reading of In Search of the Miraculous, and began to incorporate those ideas into his doctoral dissertation. And I was in graduate school at the same time and was also very interested in his ideas, and we began to study this teaching and realized that The Fourth Way is an esoteric teaching, prevented a radically different psychology and had a profound effect on each of us in terms of our understanding of what psychology, what Western psychology is and what real psychology is, because we both very quickly concluded that The Fourth Way presented a psychology which we regarded as being light years beyond that which academic psychology offers. So in terms of writing about The Fourth Way, at one point, Chris, you did your dissertation on the nature of consciousness based on The Fourth Way teaching, and I did my master's thesis incorporating some of your ideas and trying to expand on them. But I began to write about The Fourth Way, and one of the questions that I really had was, who was Gurdjieff? And I struggled for a long time with this, and I explained last week that for many years I gave up writing about Gurdjieff because I just could not seem to deal with this question, and it really sort of befuddled me that I could repeat what I'd read in books, but I didn't really want to do that. I wanted to try to explain what I understood about him. And it wasn't until after many years of sort of surrendering and giving up on trying to write about him that I came across a book by Northrop Frye, a great Canadian literary scholar, called The Double Vision, in which he talks about the Bible and he talks about Jesus and how he's discussed in the Gospels. And in talking about Jesus, there was a great quote. Frye says that Jesus is presented in the Gospels in terms of myth, and he says myth is not historical, and Jesus is not presented in the Gospels as a historical figure. He says rather he is, and I quote, a figure who drops into history from another dimension of reality, and thereby shows what the limitations of the historical perspective are, unquote. So when I read that, that really seemed to turn the lights on for me in terms of understanding Gurdjieff, because I realized that I'm not comparing Gurdjieff to Jesus, but I think that Frye's comment that Jesus should be likened to a figure who drops into reality from another dimension really kind of captured what was unique about Gurdjieff's level of consciousness and being. And from that perspective, I realized that to a certain extent, we can consider Gurdjieff as a historical figure, because after about 1912, we start to get all sorts of accounts from others as to his life and his teachings, and all of them are interesting and reliable to a certain extent, but still there's the question as to who he was and what his mission was, and I realized that for me that Frye's comment about a historical figure dropping into history from another dimension of reality was, in a way, was a key to understanding that really the question of kind trying to come to terms with Gurdjieff as a historical figure is somewhat of a misleading question, and it's an attempt to sort of normalize him and to try to understand him in terms that don't really capture his unique essence. And I think really his biographers, there's been two major English biographies about Gurdjieff, one by James Webb called The Harmonious Circle, and one by James Moore called Gurdjieff, The Anatomy of a Myth. And I think both of those biographers, in an attempt to provide something of an objective portrait of Gurdjieff, have normalized him and tried to explain him in solely in human terms, and I think that really misses the point. So I would suggest that Frye's comment really points that we have to go beyond the strict historical perspective in order to understand Gurdjieff. And what I didn't talk about last week, which I just wanted to raise, was that on the basis of my understanding from Frye's comment, I eventually wrote a book called An Alien Intelligence, and the subtitle was G.I. Gurdjieff, The Fourth Way, and the Three Brain Beings on the Planet Earth. And in that book, the word alien, I use the word alien because it's defined in Webster's as, quote, differing in nature or character, typically to the point of incompatibility, unquote. And I realized that in terms of coming to grips with Gurdjieff's consciousness and being, that really this is what I saw in his consciousness and being, was that it was incompatible with our ordinary understanding of things. And so I thought that really that the best way to describe him was as an alien intelligence. Now, I don't really mean that he was an extraterrestrial. I'm not saying that he came down from another planet. But in a sense, what I'm saying is that he is, I think, in some way an incarnation of or a messenger from some sort of higher dimensional intelligence. And even though that seems kind of fanciful and maybe straight people as being ridiculous, I think that at the very least you have to give serious consideration to that idea in order to come to grips with Gurdjieff, and that really it's no more preposterous than trying to understand him as a strictly historical character. And in terms of the alien intelligence, I also, my selection of that term was to not only talk about Gurdjieff, but also to talk about the Fourth Way, because as I studied the Fourth Way teaching, and I think Chris had the same reaction, we both sort of came to agree with what something that Uspensky said, which was that in studying the Fourth Way as a teaching, after a while you begin to gain a sense of not just the teaching as being not just another system or set of ideas or a philosophical perspective, but rather it's like being in contact with something organic, and that the more you put into it, the more it grows and the more it transforms itself. And so again, I wanted to suggest that the fourth way as a teaching is an alien intelligence. And then finally, in a third sense, I thought that an alien intelligence also described what I was trying to develop within myself by studying Gurdjieff's teaching. That is, I was trying to awaken something within myself which was different to the point of incompatibility with who I was. Like the self that I was trying to awaken, the self that I was trying to develop, really was an alien intelligence in terms of the intelligence that I pass myself off as a normal human being. Chris, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, a variety of things. Picking up a couple of the threads from different things you're saying, I think firstly, you point out, like, in modern times, we don't have this notion of how there might be distinctively different types. Like Gurdjieff says that, in a way, there are seven levels of men, and that in life, ordinarily, people are men number one, two, or three, whether dominated by their physical, emotional, or mental aspects. And that the first level of awakening of a higher type is to attain to the level of man number four, who kind of develops the three sides of his nature, and then attains self-realization, or the awakening of higher emotional center. And then Gurdjieff says people on a lower level, like, we can't judge or appreciate what higher types might really be like. And I think that's what you're getting at, like, Uspensky talked about Gurdjieff, is like, here was a man who was of a different type, like a higher type. And ordinarily we can't really appreciate that because we don't know ourselves in the first place. We don't know how limited we are, and we can't understand what it would really be like to be of a higher type and what that even means. And we don't have that idea. Like, we think of evolution, but we think of evolution only in terms of the physical body and the formation of the morphology of the body. But we don't understand how there might be a form of alchemical, spiritual transformation. And that's also the evolution of the inner man or woman. Like, the attainment of what Gurdjieff calls the higher being bodies, and what it would mean for someone to develop the higher being bodies, and how that person might be able to manifest in ways that ordinarily we couldn't understand at all. So you really, you know, that such a person like Gurdjieff then becomes an alien as judged from the levels of the lower types, like man number one, two, or three, can't judge a man number five, six, or whatever Gurdjieff happened to attain to. So I think that's really important in terms of how we don't understand this idea of higher types. And that's partly, as you're saying, like, partly what's behind the notion of Gurdjieff as an alien intelligence, in a way, like embodying intelligence of a higher order, and that we have to strive to attain an understanding of that. So that's one aspect, and I like a quote from Patterson's book. Jim, you may be able to know the exact wording of this, but where Gurdjieff says, like, you don't know what's behind me. Do you remember the quote I'm referring to?
I'm glad you reminded me of that, because I mentioned last week that in contrast to James Moore and James Webb, who weren't really students of the Fourth Way, William Patrick Patterson, who is a contemporary teacher, writer, and student of the Fourth Way, and who has been taught by Lord Pentland, who was one of the people charged with the responsibility of carrying on Gurdjieff's work after his death, has written several books about Gurdjieff and the Fourth Way, and he just assumes the position that you can't understand this person as strictly in normal terms, and to just try to describe him as a human being really misses the mark. And he says, even amongst some people who study the Fourth Way, th- there'll be comparisons of Gurdjieff, that he'll be labeled a mystic or a philosopher. And Patterson's question is, well, to what mystic or what philosopher should he be compared? And he says it's really inadequate. But the quote that you're referring to, which is really, I think, points to this idea of higher conscious beings who are of a higher consciousness, a higher level of consciousness and being, is Gurdjieff told one of his pupils at one point, I'm a small man compared to those who sent me.
Oh, yeah.
Which And which is, in a way, I like that because I really like that quote a lot. I think that's really one of the most extraordinary things he ever said because, in a sense, you have Gurdjieff, who is a remarkable character, a remarkable teacher, a remarkable human being, and yet he's saying that, you know, I'm not unique, and in fact, I'm, you know, there are higher beings than myself. I'm a small man compared to those who sent me, which just points to the whole idea of, like, the higher levels of scale in terms of consciousness and being that might exist.
Yeah. Yeah, and in a way, like, Gurdjieff even discusses that in his book, Bales Above Tales to His Grandson.
Yeah.
He does talk about certain beings in history who, quote, are actualized from above. He uses that phrase. And it's like they embody this kind of higher dimensional intelligence, and they're actualized from above, and they serve humankind. Like, he talks of various sacred messengers who are actualized from above during human history. And in a way, well, that's one angle on, but then another angle on it, when you said about Gurdjieff not, what struck me at one point, you were in reference to the planets and the sun, and one thing most remarkable about Gurdjieff's teaching is how, in a way, that he's saying that each human being, we have different levels within us, which are connected to different levels of the world orders, like what he calls the ray of creation. So Gurdjieff says there's a level in us which corresponds to the level of the sun, and there's another level that corresponds to the level of the moon, and another to the planets, and then another to the level of the divine world, which is the starry world. So he's saying that there's this, that in a way we are actualized from above, that we have the level of the stars and the sun and the planets and the moon and the earth, all of these levels within ourselves. So in a way we are actualized from above. And Gurdjieff explains how your essence is influenced by the position of the planets and the sun and the energies of these things. So that affects our essences just like as in astrology. So in a way it's part of the cosmic clockwork which actualizes us from above. So we do have that kind of, in the Gurdjieff teaching, in a way we are aliens in a sense we don't even know ourselves. Like in a way our higher self is said to exist at the level of the sun. And so the sun is like this world, this higher level of intelligence and awareness, and it's connected to the physical sun, but it's also something within ourselves. So in a way, it's this whole higher dimensional model of what it means to be a human being. And in a way, from that perspective of that understanding, ordinarily we would judge that as like alien, like it's some, you know, it's an alien understanding from the perspective of a man number one, two, or three, you know, how we might be connected within the cosmos. Like Gurdjieff says, for instance, if we attained to ourself and attained our real I, we would become immortal within the limits of the solar system. Okay, that's one of the aims in developing your fourth body. Is you become immortal within the limits of the solar system. So you've actually actualized your higher being body and have continued existence through the life of the solar system. So that's like a really higher dimensional kind of understanding of what it is to be a human being and what we might attain.
Yeah, well, that's... mistaken. No, I was just going to say that's a very articulate expansion on what I was suggesting when I said that, you know, that the third aspect of in my title of my book was an alien intelligence. Is that that's what you're trying to become conscious of and awaken within yourself? Like Gurdjieff says, all of this exists within us. It's just it's dormant, that we don't know it because we're not properly conscious. But if we were to transform the level of our consciousness and being, we would be aware that this already exists within us and connects us to these higher dimensions of reality.
Yeah.
And as you say, all of that is alien because it differs to the point of incompatibility with our normal waking consciousness and our what he calls our normal waking state of sleep. I mean,
yeah,
that's the interesting thing about the fourth way teaching. That really the inherent contradiction is that Gurdjieff presents this very severe view of human beings as being existing in their normal state of consciousness as a waking sleep, he says, and that we don't possess a permanent and indivisible I, and that we are under illusions about our capacity to do and our will, that everything happens to us because we are essentially broken machines to whom and in whom everything happens. But the other side of his teaching, which is so inspiring, and this is where his level of consciousness and being is very important, is that he says you can't imagine what your possibilities are if you were to be properly conscious and if you were to awaken, to your entire being. You just haven't a clue as to what miraculous possibilities human beings possess.
Yeah. Yeah. And both, and it's interesting, the fourth way begins with the idea even that we have basic misunderstandings about how we think we are properly conscious, how people think that they possess free will, and how they think they know unified I. So we have those kind of central illusions to knowing ourselves and what we are. And so we have to begin by realizing the state we're in, and then, like, we don't understand what it would really mean for a person to attain their real I and to live in that higher state of consciousness, say self-consciousness, or objective consciousness as higher conscious levels for Gurdjieff. We can't understand what those things would entail. And we have already so many illusions and false understanding of what we are. Like, we think we have will, but we don't realize what it would mean to acquire the will of the higher self, like what that will would be. And what that consciousness might be, and what that capacity to do, and the kind of unified in ourselves to have attained our real I. Gurdjieff says every man should strive to attain his real I within ourselves. So yeah, and then I think also very important in the Gurdjieff teaching is that as we do this, we develop our kind of astral and mental body, so we would be able to experience and manifest, you know, within the subtle dimensions and so on.
Yeah, so, and that again is one of the things that that in reviewing Gurdjieff's life and his relationship with his pupils, I think there are numerous instances in which he gave indications that he had, on some level, mastered, had control of these higher being bodies and was able to manifest on them. Like, at one point, he communicated telepathically with Uspensky. I was going to tell that story at some point. And there are other instances of him healing people, but he would also urge his pupils to draw on his, what he called his Handbuildzeugen, which is a was the energy of his astral body, and he claimed that through his spiritual development that he had more of this energy than he needed for himself and that others could draw on this. And this is, again, this challenge is sort of a conventional Western perspective on people, is that we don't recognize this, but this is this idea that masters can provide this spiritual energy to their pupils exists in all esoteric traditions, and it goes by different names, but it goes across like Christian, Muslim, Jewish. It's in every Buddhist. It's in every major religious tradition. Is that the guru or the master or the teacher can enable the spiritual progress and development of the pupil by providing this spiritual energy, and he's very specifically, there wasn't any dissembling on his point on this, as he said that, you know, that people should be able to draw on his energy and to try to use it for themselves. I was going to say, too, it's interesting because one of the things that I brought up last week about one of the difficulties in sort of coming to terms with Gurdjieff and who he was is that he was very much an actor, and he was a conscious actor, and that he played roles for various reasons that nobody can really understand, and that he was in many ways a rather outrageous and controversial character. And I quoted all the different labels that have been applied to him, but my favorite description of him came from there was a review of, I think it was a Kenneth Walker book in Time magazine in the 50s, and the reviewer said that Gurdjieff seems to have been a remarkable blend of P.T. Barnum, Rasputin, Freud, Groucho Marx, and everybody's grandfather, unquote. Which is, like, I mean, I love that because in a way it really captures the essence of, captures the superficial personality aspects of him, and it captures the essence of his personality in a sense that he played all these different parts and was somewhat of a zany character at times and outrageous character and very funny and yet there was a lot of people, that's sort of all they see, is they see the superficial aspect, but you really have to go beyond that to understand the complete man and to understand that this was an act that he was putting on for others' benefit, and if you're just satisfied with the surface, then you're not really going to come anywhere near understanding the man. I quoted from various people. I quoted from last week. I've quoted from Kenneth Walker and others about the unique level of Gurdjieff's being, but I wanted to quote today, there's a quote from Margaret Anderson, who is one of Gurdjieff's pupils and wrote a really good book called The Unknowable Gurdjieff, and she wrote that, and this is about Gurdjieff and about his teaching, and I think that this really captures something very important about him. She says that he had a presence impossible to describe because I had never encountered another with which to compare it. He was known as a great teacher, and the knowledge he had to offer was that which, in occult books and in the schools of the East, is given through allegory, dialogue, parable, oracle, scripture, or direct esoteric teaching. Gurdjieff presented his knowledge in a terminology which would not alienate the factual minds of Western thinkers. We looked upon this man as a messenger between two worlds, a man who could clarify for us a world which we hope to fathom, the world which the natural scientists have revealed but not interpreted. What philosophers have taught as, quote, wisdom, what scholars have taught in texts and tracts, what mystics have taught through ecstatic revelation, Gurdjieff would teach as a science, an exact science of man and human behavior, a supreme science of God, world, man, based on sources outside the scope, reach, knowledge, or conception of modern scientists and psychologists. Wow. Now, yeah, that really does capture, in a sense, wouldn't you say, Chris, the unique quality of the fourth way and of Gurdjieff as a teacher?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a profound quote.
This is what's in a sense. It's funny, like in reading the biographies of Gurdjieff, how the people who wrote them, can quote these quotes and obviously know of these things, and yet they don't sort of seem to understand the implications of what this says about who we are as human beings and what we might become, and who Gurdjieff was as a human being. It's like it's sort of staring them in the face, but they sort of refuse to acknowledge it. And as I say, that's what I don't really kind of understand about his biographer's interpretation. Now, there are many other books about him written by his pupils. There were a lot of very good writers around Gurdjieff, and you gain much more of a sense of that. But it's still very peculiar to me that his biographers have missed this.
I don't think one thing, like, um, like the extraordinary nature of Gurdjieff's teaching. I'd like to just give an example of that. I think one of the most unusual aspects is how Gurdjieff says that when anyone dies, or any living organic being, a certain energy, which he at one point refers to as the soul, leaves the body and it feeds the moon. That we actually feed the moon, and he talks about the moon feeding off the souls of humankind. And then you have the idea of lunacy, like people controlled by the moon. And Gurdjieff sees it as if you in your life become crystallized in your false personality and all this hasnamas characteristics in yourself, then when you die, you're eaten carnivorously by the moon, and you need consciousness even pass to the moon, and he describes as hell as the dark side of the moon. For Gurdjieff, there's this whole, you know, the human beings have kind of soul lives, and that soul can, you know, can feed the moon, and then he says your evolution is over a very long time period, so you actually have continued existence, but you can live under the control of the moon, or you can pass into a higher level, and where you exist in relationship to the planets or to the sun. So there's this whole, there's that kind of multi-dimensional life to human souls.
That's one of the aspects of his teaching too that I think is really challenging. Is that in a way, even though it's a spiritual teaching, it's a teaching of psycho-spiritual transformation, there's nothing sort of guaranteed. There's no pie in the sky aspect to this, in the sense that he says that if you don't work on yourself, you'll die like a dog, and that really that. You know, that there's only a certain, everything's finite, like even our opportunities to evolve are finite. So even though we may live several lives in terms of working things out, opportunities for things are only last for a certain amount of time or a certain number of instances. And so that really, like, what I find in his teaching is that he really underlies sort of the urgency of everything, you know, that he talks about how people in waking sleep or under the influence of the disease tomorrow, and that really everything must be done now, even in the sense that he speaks about awakening, and he says that really if people understood what it means to be asleep, they'd realize that the only important thing is to awaken, and that people are in prison, and that the only thing important is to get out of prison, and the only way to get out of prison is to get together with other people who share the same aim and work together to escape prison, because people working together can accomplish more than somebody on their own. And it's in a sense it provides this. There's a weight to Gurdjieff's depiction of humanity and of the human condition, which is I don't think I've ever really kind of grasped that from any other, even other esoteric teachings that I've read. It's very peculiar. It's different. It's definitely unique.
Yeah, it's immensely valuable and practical as a coherent system of psychology, and then a psychology that also interrelates a human being to the structures of the cosmos. And which is very interesting and important.
Well, yeah. Historically, I think in terms of, it's interesting, like as I mentioned on previous programs, I'm writing a book in which I'm discussing your work and the historical evolution of your work called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe. And one of the things I think that I see sort of more and more clearly is how you've developed this model of human beings as multidimensional beings who exist in a multidimensional cosmos, and really, that's what the Gurdjieff system is so valuable in terms of laying that groundwork, because it really challenges all the normal assumptions we have about psychology and about the possibilities of what it means to be human, and provides a completely different kind of cartography, a map of how we exist and how the universe exists and the potential of our development within the universe, which you alluded to earlier. It's just very, very unique.
Yeah, it really is. We kind of might aspire to the sun, like for Gurdjieff, we want to attain to the level of the sun, so the sun is this kind of higher level within ourselves, and how the attaining self-consciousness in Gurdjieff's system, the self-consciousness is associated then with the sun, and so we're said to be an experiment of the sun on Earth, kind of. So in a way, the inner being can return to the sun or be eaten by the moon. And the kind of soul is between those levels of, and what will happen to it through life and then into subtle afterlife states as well. Gurdjieff describes various kind of, you know, afterlife purgatories and years that the soul can pass into, you know. So we get that we have continued existence in this kind of subtle dimensional world, and that in a way we are ourselves, I think, like alien intelligences. So like the title of your book, Alien Intelligence, is like, it's an alien system of intelligence. It's like a higher dimensional system of intelligence. But it's also suggesting that we're all aliens in a way, that we come down from these higher dimensional spaces, you know, or can pass into them. And we can be eaten by the moon and become lunatics controlled by the moon, you know. Or we can beat the sun, you know, the dark lords. They're the dark lords, and they're the light lords of light, you know. And the soul is kind of stuck in between those worlds, and you know.
Yeah, you kind of.
I see the moon also as like a higher dimensional being that extends through the brains of strings within hyperspace. So this kind of higher dimensional being possesses people's souls and can feed off the souls of people. I also really like the Gurdjieff story told by Fritz Peters of when he was a boy attending to Gurdjieff, and Gurdjieff got him to look out the window, and there was a large oak tree, and Gurdjieff asked Peters, what's on the ground around the tree, and there are all these acorns, and he asked him how many acorns. He says, oh, thousands of them. And then Gurdjieff asks the boy, and how many of those acorns will become oak trees? And Peter says, well, I don't know, maybe just only a few, maybe even none. And Gurdjieff says, yeah, that we must understand ourselves by studying nature, and how there might be all these acorns with potential for growing into oak trees, but most of them will just become fertilizer. And so, similarly in the psycho-spiritual psychology, like, we all want to become oak trees. We want to attain to our individuality, and we don't want to become fertilizer. And that's to become fertilizer is to feed the moon and possibility of future man or woman. But instead, we want to kind of become attain to ourselves so that also kind of ties in, you know, we want to attain the eye of the sun and not be kind of devoured by the lunatics of the moon, you know. And our soul is in that kind of multi-dimensional universe related to those poles of existence, you know. The moon is below the earth in the ray of creation, further from the sun, you know.
You can see how how, in comparison to what we were talking about earlier, about how modern science has taken all consciousness and it, you know, ensconced it in the cranial cavity of human beings, that Gurdjieff's perspective is completely the opposite, is that are completely, as human beings, we're completely involved in the cosmos in various levels of consciousness and being, and that our possibilities are great, but we're not separate from nature. We're directly involved in the entire cosmic scheme. And it's like when you talk to, like, in amplifying on these ideas, it's like I realize that, you know, you're just sort of giving us much deeper sense of, like, this idea of an alien intelligence. And interestingly enough, in Gurdjieff's masterpiece, his magnum opus, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, he takes his voice, he appropriates the voice of an alien intelligence. He's Beelzebub, and he's telling these tales to his grandson about the three-brained beings who inhabit the planet Earth and the history of what's happened on the Earth. That's in that book, he conveys on a very deep emotional level how an extraterrestrial intelligence would look at this madhouse planet Earth and these peculiar human beings who inhabit it. And it really engenders in the reader this sense of distance from everything, you know, that we understand about ourselves and everything we take on faith as our history. In the beginning, he says something like his intention is to corrode without mercy all the rubbish accumulated in human mentation, or something to that effect. And really, that's what he does. That's what he achieves in that book. I mean, and the more you read it and understand it, the deeper the emotional impact of this is. But this is a good example of what I was talking about earlier too, is that just this term, an alien intelligence, is that you begin to explore different angles and different aspects of it from the fourth way teaching, and you see how much, you know, something that you can understand on one level becomes much deeper and much more penetrating, and that it's really, everything is related to everything else in the teaching, and there's an internal coherence which provides more and more illumination the deeper you penetrate into the meaning of things.
Yeah, for sure. It takes time to kind of appreciate as such a coherent system of knowledge and way of conceiving the anatomy of a human being. Like, it provides keys to that. I think the idea of seeing ourselves as sevenfold, and that's so important. Like, it amazes me in the Gurdjieff teaching, he explains how an ordinary mind sees everything dualistically, like mechanical mind sees everything dualistically. And you see how in the Gurdjieff fourth way teaching, the fundamental cosmic laws are the laws of three and seven. So if you in a way, you can apply the formula that the one becomes three and then seven, just like white light is divided by a prism, or the three modes of nature, and produces seven-dimensional universe. And that pattern of 1, 3, 7 is articulated in different cosmoses and on different orders of scale. So there's that kind of high. I'm trying to get at. So there's kind of this intelligence in the design and the phenomena of nature, and we can analyze them within those patterns of thinking in terms of the laws of three. So we're three-brained beings, and we can become of seven types. So there's this kind of model of the mathematics of evolution, you know, and you have that with trying to understand how a human being might be capable of an octave of development, and attain seven levels of man, and then the final eighth would be kind of like unification with God, kind of say, and eight is a kind of number of infinity. So this kind of cosmic scale illustrated by the law of sevens. So there'd be seven levels of the cosmos and of ourselves. And we can kind of evolve or devolve on that ladder of evolution. So it's a really very profound teaching. And then it gives a model of how higher states of consciousness might be related to cosmic phenomena. So the attainment of self-consciousness is related to the inner physics of the sun and how we are in higher dimensional space. We are sons of the sun. We have that element within ourselves. We can attain to the level of the sun or even attain our eye within the divine world, which is the fourth body, the fourth room, Gurdjieff explained. So attain to the star. It's like the first principle of magic with Aleister Crowley. Every man and woman is a star. So the idea that there is such a divine source emanation within the human being, and that we can attain to that realization of that, or we can die like dogs.
Gotta
feed the moon.
What were the choices for you?
And have this longer phase of evolution. But yeah, it's just so interesting. It's so many angles on the alien intelligence. I mean, in Beelzebub's tales to his grandson, Beelzebub, this character, was an angel, as a youth, he intervened in the maintenance of the cosmos. He thought something was unjust, and he kind of organized a rebellion and kind of interfered in what he shouldn't. It was none of his business. So
stuck his nose where it wasn't.
Our cosmos, and he actually set up and lived on the planet Mars. So he actually had an observatory on Mars. And I mean, now many people think that there's even a human place on Mars, and that there is evidence of Mars of prior civilizations and observatories and pyramids and faces and things. Some people think there are beings on Mars, and NASA's kind of lied about the nature of Mars and colored the photos of it. And so, I mean, in terms of modern ideas about aliens, like Gurdjieff says, there are beings on the moon who tunneled the moon out. So he kind of sees it as a realm where there are these beings. So he has so he lives on Mars and he visits the Earth. And how does he get here but a spaceship? People think there are spaceships. There's reasons to believe there are spaceships. I mean, Gurdjieff was talking about this 1922-23 period when...
Yeah.
So he was talking about visiting here from Mars as an alien. And he as Beelzebub, he has a bit of a tail. So he's kind of reptilian a little bit or something, and then you grow horns. So he's kind of an alien being, but passes among human beings, and some of his kinsmen do too. So there's these kind of aliens which interbreed with people on planet Earth. And it even goes back to the Atlantean times. So it has some relationship to, things like David Icke says about reptilian class or other aliens that have interbred with human beings, The whole thing is very complex, He says there are other beings on Saturn and other planets, I forget all his descriptions of these things. Mm. So he sure had a view of kind of, in a way, although Beelzebub's tales has traditionally, I think, been interpreted more symbolically, like it's also very profound in terms of an alternate view of how, there might have been other beings on other planets or our system, and there might be beings actualized from above, and there are these higher alien intelligences. In fact, we all have those kind of alien sources,
Well, he certainly,
what we think we are, kind of,
Yeah, and he certainly provides an interesting perspective on the idea that messengers from above that have come throughout human history and have come to help human beings to overcome their very low state of being and consciousness, and what's happened in terms of responses to these efforts on the on behalf of these higher intelligences. I wanted to go back to one thing that before I forget, because at the end of the show last week, I got a call, which was great because I didn't even give out the number, and I got a telephone call from this guy John, our listener John, and John had some very interesting questions, and because I had been speaking about Gurdjieff as a person who had attained a higher level of consciousness and being, and John phoned and said, well, as a person of higher consciousness and being, does that mean he was somebody who could do? And I said, well, yeah. And he said, well, okay, given that, how is it that Gurdjieff had this serious car accident? And he said, my understanding is that after he had this car accident, many of his pupils left him. And I said, well, you know, this is sort of skipping ahead of the story a little bit, but because I still hadn't gotten Gurdjieff out of Russia, I was mainly discussing his relationship with Uspensky in Russia even before the revolution of 1917. But I said, well, that happened in 1924 when Gurdjieff had relocated to the West, and he had an institute of for the harmonious development of man outside of Paris in Fontainebleau, and he had established the institute there in 1922. And he had this car accident in 1924. And I said, that, you know, there's different angles on sort of understanding what actually happened, because this is a very great shock, because in a sense, because he was supposed to be a man who could do, things weren't supposed to happen to Gurdjieff, but it happened that he had this car accident. And I said, you know, he also asked me a question, and I'm sorry, I haven't been able to review what exactly the conversation, so I can't remember precisely the terminology, but it was about karma, and I was a little hesitant to reply to this in terms of karma, because it's sort of it's something that is sort of outside of my grasp of this incident, and also it sort of mixes a term that I don't really feel comfortable talking about Gurdjieff. But I said, you know, there's different angles on this accident. Like, in one sense, like Uspensky, who had separated from Gurdjieff by this point and was teaching his system in London, visited the scene of the accident a few days later and was really quite shocked and very disturbed by this, and felt that this was in some way a sign that an indication that Gurdjieff had lost contact with the source of his teaching, and that he was in the throes of something very dark, and that this shouldn't have happened, and he was very, very disturbed. And another way, like Gurdjieff said later, that, you know, people attract influences in life according to their level of being, and he said that this was the completion of something which, through his own struggles, he had been contending with throughout his life, and that it was sort of the last gasp in terms of this struggle. And then, of course, there's the sort of more mundane explanation as to what happened, is that Gurdjieff was busy running his institute, and at the same time he was having difficulty financing it, so he was working in Paris, and he was running back and forth, and was overworked and overtired, and may have just fallen asleep at the wheel, or lost focus, lost his concentration. And then there's two, that he was, by all accounts, the world's most dangerous driver. He was an absolute lunatic behind the wheel. And so, like, there's different angles in explaining it. And as I said to John, there's another school of thought that really the accident wasn't anywhere near as bad as it was portrayed, that Gurdjieff staged this on some level because he was said to be near death, but there's a school of thought that he had colluded with his doctors and that he really wasn't as seriously injured as he said he was, and that really this was an excuse for him to change the focus and the impetus of his teaching, and that really that's what happened, is that after the accident, as I said to John, his pupils didn't leave him because of the accident. What happened was that Gurdjieff announced that he was going to close his institute and never reopen it, and some people took him immediately at his word and packed up and left, and others hung around, and the institute didn't close. He continued to run the institute for many years afterwards, but he wasn't as actively involved in it as he had been in the first 2 years of its existence. And what happened was that Gurdjieff began to, William Patrick Patterson says that this was the shock which awakened in him the realization that his attempts to create what he calls helper instructors, those people, those pupils who would continue to teach his system, hadn't really brought to him the people that he felt comfortable with to transmit his teaching, and so he decided to write. And even though he didn't want to write, he decided that he would begin to transmit his teaching by writing. Now, like everything else about Gurdjieff, you have to kind of, you know, take all these things with a certain grain of salt, because there's maybe these things are true. All of them are true in their own way, but it's hard to sort of decipher what happened. But one thing that I was thinking about this, and I didn't, as I say, the program ended last week, and I'm not sure how much of this I got to actually say that people heard, because I was cut off before I was able to sign off properly. But one of the things is that at one point Gurdjieff talks about even a man in his system, like a man number four, somebody who has a permanent center of gravity and has achieved a level of consciousness, that they're not awake all the time, that even people in that state can fall asleep and things can happen to them. The idea is that he talks about the law of accident and the law of fate, and the idea is that by attaining to a higher level of consciousness and being a man number four, you can get out from underneath the influences of the law of accident. But he seems to have been, in this case, have been under the law of accident. So even though a person who has attained this level may be relatively free, it's like that they're not always free. Now, I don't know, like, what do you think about that, Chris? Like, I mean, how would you sort of comment on what's your interpretation of that accident and how that relates to the idea of Gurdjieff as being somebody who could do and who was supposed to be free of accident but obviously did have an accident?
I think Gurdjieff, like, says that there are different levels to our souls, and there's a level of the law of the accident, which is kind of more under the influence of the moon and the earth, and that kind of lower level, and then there's the law of fate, and fate is related to the planets and the sun, and then I think there's even a third destiny, law of destiny, kind of, which would be to attain our eye. So there's kind of these three possibilities and their levels in ourselves. And I think, like, to me it doesn't, that could be the law of accident and be related to fate for Gurdjieff, you know, both of those levels. And that's okay, kind of, if he's still subject to those levels, like, in a way, his teaching and what he was like, okay, so, sure, he has that part of himself, too, which is under the law of accident, you know. He's not man number eight or seven or something necessarily,
yeah.
You know, and all his life, like, you know, even he, too, through his life, attained a higher level, I think, of kind of objective insight and knowledge, you know. So he doesn't have to always have been perfect, you know, in everything, you know. And his teaching is just so profound, his teaching. And so I don't have a problem with that, kind of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's my
I don't think that I would draw out the implication of Uspensky, kind of, you know, that makes it something darker, sinister, kind of, you know.
Yeah.
There were practical aspects. He tended to overdrive and worked excessively, as you say, and so he could have had an accident, you know, because he's an enlightened guy doesn't mean that he's always kind of, you know, fully in control of everything, you know.
Yeah, and not infallible by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, you know, he's not attained the level of the Pope, you know.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
No, Stephen Harper.
Yeah.
That's good. I like that. Oh, by the way, you might want to mention, you haven't mentioned today your website, and just direct people to your website.
It's www.zeropoint.ca. I haven't had a chance to work too much at the website. I'm going to try to start doing that over the next period again and put a new effort in. I haven't put up any of my newer writings on Blavatsky, the physics of Blavatsky and the secret doctrine, you know. So I may put up some of that material on the website. And, I'm offering two CDs. One CD is a copy of the BBS radio show from the year 2007. So I've kind of put those onto a CD plus the first interview with Howard Eisen from Uncensored magazine on that volume. We've got 50 hours of our show on there, Jim, which is a really nice way to way format. Sorry?
We have a caller.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi. Right. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, James and Chris. This is John, the fellow who called last week regarding the accident.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, hi. I like your explanation. It's very helpful.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
Good.
This is actually John Francis, the Chris.
Oh, John.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Oh, John Francis. Yeah,
yeah.
Hi, John. Oh, well, I had quite a time in New Zealand, had support to go around, travel through the islands.
Yeah.
I gave about 30 lectures on the heart doctrine and the
wonderful
metaphysics of the secret doctrine.
Yeah, I was listening. Yeah, James did a really great job in your absence.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks, John.
Yeah. I've got a question. James mentioned a book by an author named Fry on Jesus and, you know, interpreting his life as a, I guess, as a metaphor or something.
Yeah.
Today, what's the name? What's the full author's name and the name of the book? Do you remember?
The book that I specifically was referring to, John, was Northrop Frye, who was a Canadian literary scholar, scholar of Blake and T.S. Eliot, amongst others, and who wrote actually in the latter part of his career. He devoted quite a bit of his work to the Bible. There's a book called The Great Code, but the specific one.
The Great
that
what? I didn't hear that. The Great.
The Great Code.
C-O-D-E,
which is,
yeah.
Yeah, and but the book that I was referring to was a series of lectures. It's a smaller book. It's very good though. A series of lectures he gave called The Double Vision.
Okay.
And I would highly recommend it. I think there was a third book called Words Without Power, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'll have to check that. But I think that was his third volume that he had on the structure of criticism and how it relates to the Bible.
Yeah. So Fry,
F-R-Y-E, yeah.
Y-E. Oh, okay. And Northrop, O-P-R-O-P.
Yeah.
What's the Great Code? Is that also on the Bible, or?
Yeah, that's his major work on the Bible, and is regarded as one of the more interesting, I think, recent literary scholars' attempts to provide a perspective on the Bible. He's extremely interesting. If you're interested in scripture, or if you're interested in literature, Northrop Frye is definitely worth reading.
Yeah, I'll look into it, because there are people that are, you know, there's a lot of contradictions in the Bible and in the New Testament, Old Testament. Even in the New Testament, you can see them very clearly, because they have, you know, different Gospels are basically describing the same situation in a number of cases, and they're different in their details. And people say, well, what's going on here? It's supposed to be inspired, and you have all the details. They're contradicting each other, you know, about Jesus' birth, all these different things. But I think what people miss is that the Bible was never intended to be a history book, you know, accurate historically. It was meant to encode higher metaphysical teachings using metaphors.
That's precisely what Northrop Frye argues.
Yeah, so people who criticize it based on his story. And that's why they allowed all these contradictions in it. They wasn't that, you know, if they wanted to clean it up, they could have eliminated the contradictions, you know. But they're there for... to give these teachings. Okay. Well, that's very good. I enjoy your program, and I'll keep listening. And welcome back, Chris.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot, John.
Yeah, all right. Bye.
Well, that was nice.
Yeah.
I wondered last week if I didn't ask John if it was John Francis, because I was so surprised that I got a call that afterwards I realized, oh, that might have been John Francis. I should have asked him, you know, so that's great.
Okay, so how are we doing? Oh, yeah, so I was mentioning, so I'm going to promote that one CD of our last year's show, and then the CD I have, I put the four-hour lecture series, the kind of basic teaching I do on consciousness and the heart and self-remembering. I presented that material in a four-hour lecture series. So I put that on a CD, and with it, the two PowerPoint presentations I've been using to illustrate the Doctrine of the Heart, and then the Blavatsky's metaphysics. So I put my PowerPoint presentations and the 4 hours of lectures and two radio shows, interviews I've done, onto another CD, which I'm going to make available. I sent you copies of those, Jim.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in listening to the radio programs again that we did together, but I'm more interested in listening to your work than, you know. I think that the whole year's worth of our 0 point presentations is, in a sense, that, you know, we're sort of climbing a difficult mountain here, because we're trying to provide an entirely different perspective on the nature of virtually all and everything, and you can't possibly begin to transmit that in one session or two sessions. Is sort of a cumulative process, and it requires a certain amount of work on the part of the listener to begin to understand a different framework and to try to interpret things in a different framework. So, in a way, I think it would probably be very useful to listen to, you know, of the whole series of our programs and to gain a sense of what we're trying to get at, and you know, as I say, it's not something that you can do overnight. It's a process, but the process in and of itself is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we go back often to discuss the basic heart doctrine and the idea of psychology of the soul and the idea of the evolution of the inner human being, and, you know, we go over these things, 0 points, and kind of understand the metaphysics a bit. And, you know, we have quite a pretty varied show in what we're considering, and kind of higher dimensional models of human existence.
In terms of the Gurdjieff teaching, I mean, you know, kind of repeat this many times about how, you know, this idea that we're not properly conscious, and that our waking state, our normal waking state, is a state of waking sleep in which we don't have will or unity in the sense of a permanent and indivisible I. Like, these are basic ideas, and how we don't remember ourselves. These are basic ideas, but you have to kind of keep revisiting them to try to incorporate them and try to make them part of your interpretive framework and to serve as reminding factors that there's a different way to try to understand the nature of yourself and the nature of your possibilities as a human being. And that these are things that take time, but at the same time, these are very profound ideas. And for a lot of people, you know, they hear them, and I think they recognize, like they intuit, that there's something very profound here. And so that it's the beginning of seeing things in a very different way.
And I think, in a way, our studies of even someone like Gurdjieff, we add a further dimension to it through the zero-point perspective and through elaborating the heart doctrine. It's very interesting, like in Beelzebub's tales to his grandson, Beelzebub is explains to his grandson that as Beelzebub's emotional center was related to an organ in the region of the breast, he at one point said, suggesting to me that he's referring to the heart. But that it fell from there and it became distributed through the autonomic nervous plexus of the sympathetic nervous system. So this the kind of secondary emotional center, and the three brain beings on planet Earth, that was their primary emotional center. So they'd lost this original emotional center related to the heart. And when Gurdjieff talks about attaining the state of self-consciousness, he talks about the opening of higher emotional center. So we can relate the opening of the higher emotional center as to attain the level of the heart consciousness, emotional consciousness. And he talks about the importance of remorse, of conscience, all of us kind of waking up and kind of seeing what we're doing and experiencing remorse of conscience, which he describes as a fire that burns away impurities and such within the person, and allows your consciousness of the whole more. And I have lost my train of thought. Oh, could you remind me what I was saying?
Well, that was pretty good.
Also he talks about the sacred being higher emotions of hope, faith, and love.
Right.
Yeah, hope, faith, and love. So those are like higher, those are higher emotions associated with the opening of the higher emotional center. And he talks about bearing the sorrow of our endlessness. So that's something a being can do. Yeah. So one can experience this share in the sorrow of our endlessness.
I just want to say we're almost out of time, but I want to say quickly that one of the things I explained last week is Uspensky described how when Gurdjieff was teaching in Russia to the groups in Moscow and St. Petersburg, how he'd sort of he would give people the beginnings of ideas and see what they would make of them, and then he would furnish them with more depending on how they responded to what he provided. And the subtitle of In Search to the Miraculous, actually the original title, was Fragments of an Unknown Teaching. And in a sense that in Beelzebub, the teaching is presented on a very different level and in a more holistic fashion, but I think that really the really intriguing part about Gurdjieff's teaching is that it's there and you can make much more of it. I mean, there's so many areas to be developed, and I think that one thing that you've done, Chris, through your work over the last 30 years is that you have fulfilled your being obligations in terms of intellectually developing aspects of the fourth way and making them coherent in terms of modern thought, which I think is a real achievement. And, I think you should be congratulated on that, and I think that your work is unique in that aspect.
Yeah, it does. It's a valuable contribution to the Gurdjieff study of the Gurdjieff teaching and comparative study of it with modern science and psychology. Yeah, it's the Gurdjieff teaching generally is such a coherent system of knowledge, you know?
Yeah.
How they view a human being as having three brain being and having seven centers and, you know, the model of the evolution of the inner being and states of consciousness. I mean, it's all such an integrative teaching that's really very scientific in its attitude. Kind of, you know, so it's very coherent and valuable. Yeah, and then I think the way I've brought out the heart doctrine teaching, how that element is hidden in, or it's revealed in that little incident about Beelzebub saying about emotional center. So the attaining of the higher emotional center is related to the self-consciousness experience. And then beyond that, the kind of glimpses of objective consciousness, which is this kind of a higher dimensional kind of state of consciousness of perceiving the truths about the world, so kind of seeing into the subtle dimensionality of existence, attaining these higher being bodies. Like, that's so interesting. I love the Gurdjieff teaching about the higher being bodies. You know, the astral body and the mental body and then the causal body, the fourth room. So the, it's a profound kind of system of knowledge. And, I think also the idea of the zero point is an interesting element that I kind of add to the Gurdjieff perspective. And I have a very interesting quote in the work about where Uspensky says, or describes, like, seven dimensions related to each other.